Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau. I'm the president of the Independent Institute, and I'm delighted to welcome you today to our Independent Policy Forum program. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors programs featuring outstanding experts to address major social and economic issues, especially as they relate to important new books. And today is certainly no exception. For those of you who are new to the Institute, you'll find background information at your seat. The Independent Institute is a nonprofit, non-politicized, scholarly public policy research and educational organization. In addition to luncheons of this type, we sponsor research into many public policy issues. We produce about 6 to 8 books a year and hold many conference and media projects based on that work. Our purpose at the Institute is essentially a Jeffersonian one, if that's the right term, of seeking truth regardless of the impact of current conventions or prejudices in public debate. In so doing, we don't necessarily take the public pronouncements of government officials at face value, nor the conventional wisdom over serious public problems. Hence, we invite your participation and involvement, but be surprised for new and perhaps challenging perspectives from time to time. The Institute neither seeks nor accepts government funding. Instead, the Institute's support is drawn from a diversity of foundations, businesses, individuals, and other non-contracted sources. In the packet, there's also information about membership in the Institute. Many of you here are members, and we're delighted to have you join with us. Membership, of course, offers discounts and so forth, but many of you may be interested in getting a copy of one of our new books, in particular the award-winning book Out of Work, our newest book Beyond Politics, and others, which you'll find details in your packet. The Institute, in its research program, is also engaged in a series of 12 comprehensive studies on the many aspects of crime reduction and prevention in conjunction with the Koch Crime Commission in the state of Kansas. And the studies are being completed by a number of leading scholars around the country. The focus of the study is not to make it unique to Kansas, but to focus on the issues so it could be of interest in any locale. Those of you who are interested in further information on the program are encouraged to contact us at the Institute. In making our forum program possible today, I want to particularly thank the members of our host committee who very kindly assisted in joining in making our program possible today. I'd also like to introduce a number of people who are in attendance with us today. First of all, I'd like to introduce a number of Institute board members. James Fair, who's president of Zammer Production Company. Bill Koch, who's president of Oxbow Corporation. Bob Irwin, chairman of BioSource Genetics. And my particular favorite, Mary Thoreau, who's chairman of Garvey International. Very catchy name. I'd also like to introduce former San Jose mayor, Tom McEnery, who I believe is here. Admiral James Stockdale. Mark Klass, who's president of the Mark Klass Foundation for Children. And there's so many others, if I continued, we'd never get to our program, I'm afraid. But thank you all for joining with us. The issue of crime is perhaps the recurring and certainly the number one issue today in most areas around the country and many areas around the world. The question about how crime affects our communities and our economy. Why do some people become chronic, persistent criminals? Has the rise in the single-parent family and the welfare state caused a rise in crime rates? Does the U.S. rely more on prisons than other Western nations? Would more police on the street reduce crime? What about TV violence and guns? Would swifter and more certain justice make a difference? What about the death penalty and boot camps and three strikes and you're out and so forth? One of the interesting trends in the area of criminal justice is the whole field of privatization. Not only is it that many locales are seeking the assistance of private firms for cost reasons, but there's been a huge growth industry in private provision of protection, adjudication, and many other areas. From cover stories in Time and Commentary to the current PBS TV series on controlling criminal justice hosted by Bill Moyers, James Q. Wilson has become the most sought-after expert on how to systematically grapple with the persistent and controversial problem of crime and violence. We're truly delighted to be sponsoring this program today. James Q. Wilson is the James Collins Professor of Management at UCLA. He was formerly the Henry Lee Shattuck Professor of Government at Harvard University. Among his many books are Bureaucracy, The Moral Sense, his very famous book, Thinking About Crime, The Politics of Regulation, On Character, Crime and Human Nature, and so forth, and his newest book, Crime, co-edited with Joan Peter Cilia, which we have copies of today for those who would like to see or purchase copies. He was educated at the University of Redlands. He received his PhD from the University of Chicago. Professor Wilson has been chairman of the White House Task Force on Crime, chairman of the Police Foundation. He's a past president of the American Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences. He's received 6 honorary degrees and is the recipient of the James Madison Award from the American Political Science Association. I'm very pleased to introduce him to speak on the growing and persistent issue of what to do about crime, after which we will hear from a panel of distinguished experts and then answer your questions. So I'm very pleased to introduce Jim Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Thoreau. I will speak rather briefly because crime is a subject like what is wrong with the Boston Celtics and the Chicago Cubs, on which everyone has an opinion, and therefore I want to give you as many opportunities as you need to express those opinions. Much of what I'm going to say is drawn from the last chapter of my book that I edited with Joan Peter Cilia, Crime. The preceding chapters are written by other scholars, some of whom I agree with. All, however, distinguished in their field, and I'm very grateful to the Institute for Contemporary Studies here in San Francisco for assisting Joan and myself in pulling this together and publishing the book. When we think about crime, we must realize this world, this nation, faces not one crime problem, but two. The first crime problem is a problem that is nearly universal, affecting virtually all industrialized societies. And it is a problem that can be described as the enormous increase in the rate of property crime and some forms of violence, but particularly property crime, that has occurred since the late 1950s, such that today the United States does not stand alone as the most crime-ridden industrialized nation in the world. Indeed, it stands shoulder to shoulder with Sweden and Germany and Spain and England and Wales and the Netherlands as a collection of crime-ridden nations. Today, the burglary rate is higher in Sweden than it is in the United States. The chances of having your car stolen are greater in London than they are in New York City. The drug problem is everywhere. And this must reflect, given the differences among these regimes, some profound cultural change in the West. Cultural change about which we can all speculate, but for which I doubt anyone has any governmental solutions. The United States, however, does stand alone in one respect, and that is our second crime problem, the problem of violence, and of late, the problem of rising levels of juvenile violence. We now know that beginning in about 1985, coincident with the advent of crack cocaine on the streets of many large American cities, juvenile homicide rates that had been declining for 5 years, as adult homicide rates had been declining for 5 years, began to escalate. So that between 1985 and 1990, the juvenile homicide rate for white youths increased by 50%, for African American youths it tripled. There is some indication in the last few months that these rates of violent crime, particularly among juveniles, have begun to come down. But if they do come down, I doubt very much they will ever come down to the low levels they were at in what now seems, in retrospect, the benign 1960s. When we think about the problem of solving crime, therefore, we have to be clear about which one we're trying most hard to solve. The first problem, the universal problem, the property crime problem, is one that we all solve by means of self-protection. We make ourselves prisoners in our own home. We lock up everything we have, and we hire private security guards. The second problem, the problem of rising levels of juvenile violence, that is seemingly distinctive American and of relatively recent origin, demands a different kind of approach. In thinking about that, most people who have views divide them, find themselves divided into one of two camps: those who believe we must attack the root causes of crime, and those that believe we must employ the criminal justice system. Of course, everyone who thinks about this might say we should do a bit of both, but in the area of crime, like in the area of what's wrong with the Boston Celtics or the Boston Red Sox, people have very firm views. And one has an ideology on this matter that is akin to the man holding a hammer for whom all the world looks like a nail. We wish to use punishment because we are punitive. We wish to attack root causes because we think we are tender-hearted. What can we say about these two alternative approaches? First, with respect to punishment, there are certain myths that Americans have allowed themselves to believe, which I think ought to be dispelled. It is often said, for example, the United States imprisons more people in proportion to its population than any other country except South Africa and the former Soviet Union. The statement is false. Worse than false, it's meaningless, because the key issue is not how many people in proportion to the population who are in prison, but what proportion of crimes committed lead to incarceration. And if you look at violent crime rate, our use of prison is not very different from that to be found in Canada or England or Australia. With respect to property crimes, we do use prison more frequently than Canada and England and Sweden, which may be one of the reasons why their property crime rates are going up while our property crime rates are going down. A second myth I think that needs to be dealt with is that we increased dramatically the number of people in prison and got nothing in return. Crime remained high despite escalating prison populations. This is a proposition that really cannot be conclusively tested one way or the other, because we cannot conduct a controlled experiment in which all half the states imprison people and the other half don't, and we observe the consequences. But the fact of the matter is that coincident with rising prison populations, there began in roughly 1979-1980 a steep reduction in the crime rate as reported by the victimization surveys. This reduction in the crime rate, I think, was a result of three things really. First, the population was getting older, but that only explains about 25% of the decline. Secondly, it was the result of an increased probability of going to prison. And thirdly, it was the result of simply the aggregate number of people in prison at one time. Even though the time served in state prison has been going down more or less steadily for 30 years. In the 1950s, the median burglar released from prison in the United States had served 24 months. By 1985, that was down to 14 months. Even though the median burglar today has typically a much longer rap sheet than the median burglar of 30 years ago. England and Sweden have been reducing their prison population, more accurately, have been reducing the probability of going to prison, and their crime rates have been going up. We cannot prove from that correlation that one factor has caused another, but at least we can say that these relationships are not consistent with the proposition so often uttered that we have purchased nothing by the increase in the prison population. However, there are some limitations to prison which are not myths, which need to be examined seriously. One is the fact that until 1985, only about 8% of the inmates of state prisons were drug offenders. Today, 25% are, and in the federal system, the percentage is higher than 60%. We began owing to the advent of crack cocaine and the complaints in neighborhoods from coke dealing, from crack dealing, and from the juvenile violence associated with it, to take the matter seriously. We have dramatically increased the use of prison for drug offenders, and we cannot be certain what we have purchased from it. Because drug offending, unlike armed robbery or homicide, is a business, and if you take one dealer off the street, one or more dealers will rise up to take his place. It is my view that if you wish to control drug abuse, you must reduce demand. It is my view that prison or other forms of punishment have to be part of a demand reduction strategy, because young people ordinarily will not voluntarily enroll in and remain in drug treatment programs or 12-step programs or the like. But whether the use of prison space is the best way to link sanctions to a drug demand reduction strategy is so far unclear. And a good deal of creative thought needs to be devoted to the question of how best to make demand reduction strategies effective. Another criticism of our increased use of prison is that it does not adequately address the juvenile problem, and I think these critics are correct. I believe that young people are calculating, just as older people are calculating, and sometimes they are calculating with far greater precision than we. Nonetheless, it remains the case that young persons are more impulsive than older ones, have a shorter time horizon, and thus distant penalties are less likely to make a difference. Moreover, because of the conditions in inner city communities, owing to the escalation of gang violence and its association with crack dealing, gun ownership and gun violence has become necessary in the eyes of many juveniles merely for reasons of self-defense. Because of the urban arms race that has gone on, and because of our inability to curtail the extent to which young people or any people carry illegally concealed weapons on public places, we have a situation in which many inner city neighborhoods are not radically different from the innermost parts of Beirut or Bosnia. And finally, young people, especially in some neighborhoods, have, like all people, a demand for respect. But respect, when it is no longer given by the conventional sources of social respect, or when those conventional sources are themselves no longer highly regarded, then respect may take the form of exaggerated manhood, the ability to display force and to use it credibly, and even the ability to wear proudly as a badge of honor the fact that one has done time in juvenile hall. For all of these reasons, we have not yet adequately assessed the role the criminal justice system can play in controlling the most explosive part of our crime problem, which is the problem of juvenile violence. Let me turn a moment to the argument about root causes. Some of you may know, I certainly know, Chief McNamara knows, because he and I talked about this many years ago. I am not a great admirer of most root cause theories of crime, because it turns out that what people who have this view often mean are those things that they don't like about society, which, if they can blame crime on those things, perhaps they can get more government effort directed at those things. The difficulty is that though there is some relationship between poverty and crime, it is not a very close one. There is next to no relationship between crime and unemployment, or crime and the business cycle. There are many good reasons for trying to do something about poverty, providing jobs, smoothing out the business cycle, but ending crime is the worst possible reason for doing so. Indeed, much of the increase in crime that we've experienced around the world has occurred at a time of enormous gains in national prosperity and national well-being. So much so that in this century, unlike in the previous century, the crime rate has become unhinged from the business cycle. And crime is more likely to go up in periods of prosperity today than it is in periods of depression, a reversal of the situation that existed, insofar as we can tell, in the previous century. But there are root causes of crime, even though they are sometimes misidentified, and those causes are family and neighborhood. We are beginning now for the first time, I think, to talk candidly about family conditions in the United States. For some time, the 60s and 70s, people who criticized single-parent families or out-of-wedlock births were themselves criticized for stigmatizing an alternative lifestyle or an alternative family arrangement, as if all family arrangements were equally valid and one could choose among them the way you might choose among flavors at Ben and Jerry's ice cream store. But the family as we know it, as indeed every culture in every civilization in the world now knows it, is the product of tens of thousands of years of evolution and painful trial and error. The only family that has survived the test of this evolutionary experience has been the two-parent family, sometimes extended, sometimes nuclear, but always with the father and the mother, always with a marital commitment, and a marital commitment designed, among other things, to preserve and enhance the well-being of the child. There are now data that show, I think, any fair-minded observer rather conclusively, that after controlling for income, and no matter what racial or ethnic group you look at, children raised in single-parent families, headed by an unmarried, never married young woman, are materially worse off in terms of the prospects for school achievement, the prospects for entering delinquency, the prospects for having emotional problems, and indeed these risks are greater for boys than for girls, though they are by no means absent for girls. If this is the case, then we ought not to think of the problem of family structure as a black problem, or a white problem, or a problem of any particular color, because it transcends color. And it affects all segments of society. Nor should we think of it simply as a problem of financial support, because except at the very highest income level, a level achieved among women only by Murphy Brown and a few others, it turns out that a child raised in a never married mother's home or in a divorced mother's home is materially worse off. Now, what can we do about this? As many politicians have said accurately, governments don't raise children, families don't children. Nonetheless, governments can create conditions in which families are more or less likely to be healthy. We have created conditions in which families are less likely to be healthy. I do not assert that the existence of the Aid to Families of Dependent Children program, AFDC, or as it most commonly known, welfare, has caused an increase in illegitimacy. I think it has helped make it possible, but I do not think it is the sole cause. Nor do I think the business cycle is the sole cause. Indeed, if you try to explain the growth in single-parent families from the time when they began really to accelerate, which was the early 1960s, and continue to accelerate now, it turns out that neither economic factors nor changes in the inflation-adjusted value of welfare payments can explain more than a relatively small fraction of the change. The culture has changed. The culture has changed not only here but abroad. The stigma attached to an out-of-wedlock birth has gone. The sense that a male who has impregnated a female has an obligation, enforceable either by law or by the female's tough brothers, to marry the young woman has been profoundly weakened. And as a consequence, young men, and I can speak confidently about this, drawing on my own experiences, now have at a young age what they've always wanted, action and no commitment. Young girls want something else. I'm not suggesting they're uninterested in action, but they would like a separate household, out from under the thumb of their parents. And many of them would like babies, because they find babies appealing, and they want to care for them. But having grown up in a household headed by a young unmarried woman who herself got pregnant at an early age, having now gotten pregnant at an early age in her own case, and now having confronted a government program that says, if you apply for AFDC, food stamps, and housing programs, and Medicaid, you can have an independent household, they jump at the chance. And often take some delight in the fact that they can do this without the services of a male to supply some of these things. And the only ones that lose are the children. In my view, the current national debate over welfare reform is miscast. It is miscast because of the phrase, welfare reform. we think that what is at stake in this issue is how many tax dollars we're spending on poor people. Or we think what is at stake at this issue is that we're allowing people not to work. Now, those things are at stake, but there is something more fundamental at stake, and that is the well-being of these children. Children who are the unintended victims of a culture that does not any longer produce, with the same surety that it once produced, intact two-parent families whose concern was overridingly the well-being of their children. Now, can government change this? That is the debate that is going on in Washington. One view says that we can change it by going cold turkey. Let's end all welfare. Throw people on general county relief if necessary, but send an unmistakable message: you cannot use public money to support the consequences of your sexual indiscretions. That may work. Almost surely in the long run would work, but at what cost? We don't know. There are those who say that welfare recipients must work to earn their welfare payments. That may be a desirable goal, but one has to ask whether we really want the mothers of newborn infants working when there is not another parent at home to take care of the child. Do we wish to move from single-parent families to no-parent families? Possibly, but we don't know. A third alternative is to say, what can we do to supply an adequate environment for those children so that as they grow up, they will not grow up believing that sexual exploitation and the reputation thereby acquired is the object of every young male, or that sexual experimentation leading to the formation of her own household is the object of every young female. They will grow up thinking that romance and commitment and marriage are the goals they ought to seek. One possibility is to create arrangements whereby young girls, pregnant, without a husband, who apply for welfare, be told that you may have all of the benefits you're now entitled to, provided only that you do not set up an independent household. This might mean living with your own parents. But in some cases, their own parents are either abusive or have proved incompetent, as is evidenced by the fact that their child is now attempting to reproduce the cycle of illegitimacy and inevitable poverty that this has caused. So the alternative is what? The alternative, I think, is really improved adoption laws, making it easier to adopt, making in particular it easier to adopt transracially, if that is the preference of individuals, or the use of the existing welfare budget to support family shelters, group homes, where the mother and the child would live before, where the mother would live shortly before the birth, and where both would live for some time, a year, 2 years, 3 years after the birth, so that real adults who understand really how children have to be cared for will be supervising the behavior of young girls who in many cases don't know either. And with rules that say very clearly, no drugs, no alcohol, and no boyfriends on the premises. Now you may think this is a radical new idea. That idea is as old as the country itself. The Florence Crittenden Homes have been doing this for decades. There are family shelters in every part of this country that have been doing this. But they have been doing it with private money as charities. The government comes along, this large 800-pound gorilla, walks into the middle of the room, ignores history, ignores private initiatives, and says, we know best. We will, if we are liberally inclined, give the woman the money without any strings attached. Or, if conservatively inclined, we will make the woman work to earn the money. But neither asks, what will this do to the child? And how can such children be saved? And what lessons does our own society provide as to how to do it better? I think that welfare reform ought to be linked to crime control. and that we ought to understand the two are part of an indissoluble whole. I think this might help the acute American problem. I'm not at all convinced, however, that it will help the worldwide problem. Because in other countries, we have different kinds of welfare systems. Systems that do produce, in fact, more support for childhood than our system. And yet they, too, have rapidly escalating, indeed, far more rapidly than in our case, escalating rates of property crime and, to some degree, violent crime and, above all, of drug abuse. I have no idea how to deal with that larger problem. That is a problem of Western culture, Western civilization, at this particular time in its development. A culture that, born with the enthusiasm, excitement, an insight of the Enlightenment of the 18th century, which has worked its wonders in giving us economic prosperity, technological advance, scientific invention, material progress, and above all personal freedom, has now come to the point where it seems to have exhausted its moral capital. And our critics in this world, in Islamic nations and Confucian nations, are watching us, and they believe we have made the wrong decision. I don't think we have made the wrong decision, because I believe that a free people in a prosperous economy have enormous capacities for self-correction that are not available to less free people living in less prosperous economies. But this is the year, this coming century is the century where when we will find out whether I am right or they are right. Thank you very much.